Welcome to Hallel Fellowship on the internet at hallel.info. Why did Messiah Yeshua, or Christ Jesus, initially say he would not go to Sukkot, the Feast of Tabernacles recorded in John 7, but then he showed up later incognito? The answer seems to be in the celebration itself, heaven's instruction to live in temporary dwellings for a week. Sukkot calls us to humble ourselves, remembering our dependence on God. By dwelling in fragile shelters, we recall Israel's wilderness wanderings, a time of stripping away self-reliance to learn trust in the divine provider. This annual celebration challenges us to let go of earthly securities, to live vulnerably before our Maker. In an age of increasing self-sufficiency, Sukkot's message rings prophetic. True strength comes not from what we can accumulate, but in recognizing our smallness before the Almighty. By embracing this humility, we open ourselves to receive God's grace and blessing.
I'm going to ask you a few questions, some rhetorical, some honest, like I actually want answers from you, all right? So bear with me on those of you who are in the audience, because this is audience participation today, a little bit. First of all, you'll note that when Jeff was reading Leviticus, the 22, Leviticus 22 and through 23, it starts at the tail end of chapter 22. This is a minor point, but it's designed to get our minds in the mindset of treating animals well when we're about to kill them for offering sacrifices. It's kind of weird, but it's a strange thought process. So this the Torah portion covers that, discuss that mindset. But there's a reason it does that, and we'll talk about that a little bit today. Not a whole lot, but a little bit. In throughout Leviticus 23, it discussed a few things when it comes to Sukkot. So when Sukkot, this time period, it requires us to dwell in booths or temporary dwelling places. I'm not going to talk about booths, but I'll talk about the concept behind what they're asking. So first of all, I have a question for you to think about. Don't answer this rhetorical one. Why does God want us to remember that the Israelites dwelled in booths? Just think about that. Don't answer. Just think about all the things you can think of. Why would God want us as people, generations later, hundreds or thousands of years later, to remember that the Israelites dwelt in booths for 40 years. So think about that and put it in the back burner just to mull it over as we go through some of this today. Okay, so we have that on our thought process to thinking about it. When Messiah comes along in John chapter 7 and says, this isn't my time to go to the Feast of Tabernacles, but it is your time, why would Messiah say, no, not my time, and yet show up a few days later? It's a question. Why was he doing that? What's he trying to teach? What example is he showing? What's his intent behind saying, no, I'm not going to go, but you should go. And then later says, now I'm going to go. What was he doing? He had something in his mind, something he was thinking about when he made those instructions to his brothers, that they can go ahead of time. Now is your time. You can go, but not mine. But then later he shows up almost incognito on the side. No one would notice him. Why? Why didn't just tell them, I'm going to show up later in a few days when no one notices? Right? Wouldn't that have worked? Don't know why, but he could have told them that. He didn't. He snuck in without notifying anyone. So we have to ask ourselves, okay, why was Messiah doing that? What is the connection? What's the purpose behind him hiding himself at Sukkot? Why not just show up? He may have been curious about their actions, what they would do. Would they go ahead and travel along without him or not? Maybe. It's possible. I would argue there's probably a different reason, and we're going to discuss that a little bit as well. It has to do with the first rhetorical question I asked you. Why is God having us remember the Israelites, what they did, 40 years, thousands of years ago? They're connected. That's the reason why Messiah was doing this. He actually does explain it a little bit, just a teeny bit, in his explanation he gives to his brothers. Just a little bit. He gives a slight hint as of what he was trying to get them to think. So we have to ask ourselves that question. We'll talk about, I wish I had a whiteboard right here. Anyway, I'll make do with what I got. So the next question I have, also, we'll go through a little bit of this as well. In Nehemiah chapter 8, which discusses the Israelites for their first time in since Joshua, I think it was, asking about, or learning, I should say, about Sukkot, learning it for the first time for most of their whole life. They've never heard it before. And then they chose to express their humiliation, their humbleness, in going out in the bushes and grabbing bushes and making sukkahs. They were humiliated or embarrassed or ashamed that they themselves and their forefathers had not been honoring Sukkot for all these generations. We ask ourselves, okay, why would that be their expression of humiliation? Why is they choose that as opposed to just the bowing? Like, for example, many people, I don't know about you personally, who feel shame. Shame is a very strong emotion, by the way. When we feel shame, the first instinct is to hide. That's our first instinct. And then if we have enough forethought or thoughts about it, we realize we can hide, but then ask for forgiveness or go to God and plead, I'm sorry, I screwed up. That's kind of the level of shame. Oh, granted, there's I'm not a psychiatrist. There's other levels of emotion beyond that I don't know. But that's generally what I've seen, at least. Usually it's a hide aspect first to conceal yourself because you're embarrassed, as opposed to, oh no, let's go build booths. That's not the normal reaction of humiliation or embarrassment. That's not a common response. But it would be if we understood why they're doing it. So we'll discuss that a bit as well today. And of course, well, there's a lot of examples we'll cover on this topic. So let's go through this a little bit. So keep those questions in your mind regarding why God's asked them to do this. What is his reasoning for it? So we can learn what our reasoning is, what we're supposed to be remembering during this time period. It's not just they hung out for 40 years camping. That wasn't the objective, okay? We can all remember camping, but that's not the reason. It doesn't matter about the camping part. There's a purpose God has behind why he said, remember this stuff, and remember what they did. So let's jump all the way back to a little bit in Leviticus 23 and reread a certain section of that. My little tiny Bible, actually I borrowed my wife's Bible. It's super fine print. And my eyes are getting old, so bear with me. Get it? I realize some of you are a lot older than I am. I'm still noticing it, though. Go back to Leviticus 23. These are fine print here. So jump down to verse 20. No, where is it? 33. Yeah, 33, 34. So 23, verse 33, and continue, I'll reread a portion of this. This is in a New King James Version Bible. Verse chapter 23 of Leviticus, verse 33, rereads just a portion. Lord spoke to Moses saying, hold on a minute. These are fine print. Speak to the children of Israel, saying, the 15th day of the seventh month shall be the Feast of Tabernacles, which we're doing. For 7 days, to the Lord. On the first day should be a holy convocation. You should do no kosher work upon it. For 7 days, you offer an offering made by fire to the Lord. On the eighth day, you have a holy convocation, offering fire to the Lord, with the sacred assembly. You shall do no kosher work. That's pretty much all we're given on, you know, for the most part, this holiness itself as the first and last days. And then jumping down to verse 39, discuss a little bit about it. On the 15th day, the seventh month, when you have gathered in the first your fruit, you shall keep the feast of the Lord 7 days. The first day should be a Sabbath rest, the eighth day a Sabbath rest. Take yourselves on the first day the fruit of leafy trees, of branches of palm trees, willows of the brook, and you shall rejoice to the Lord for 7 days. You should keep 7 days, Lord, statue forever, yada, yada, yada. So we have these little bushes being brought up, right? Trees and bushes being brought up. And we would think intuitively, oh, there's supposed to be secret about bushes and trees, which is true. By the way, Sukkot is a lot about bushes and trees. But that's not the reason we're actually remembering Sukkot. It's a part of the reason, but it's not the reason, all right? The reason Moses tells us the reason we're remembering Sukkot. It's recorded in the entire chapter of 8, or Book of Deuteronomy, chapter 8. Moses spells out the entire reason. Deuteronomy 8 spells the entire reason, what we're supposed to be remembering for Sukkot. So although we can have bushes and trees and plants and everything, which is great and wonderful, and even sukkahs, but the reason we're doing this is recorded in Deuteronomy 8. So let's go to Deuteronomy chapter 8 and tell what Moses tells us what we are to remember for Sukkot. All right? Deuteronomy 8 spells it out very explicitly. I'll go find Deuteronomy 8 again. Deuteronomy chapter 8, every commandment which I command you today, you must be careful to observe. Oh, God bless you, Jeff. You were awesome. My scribbling notes, I need scribbling notes. I'm a very tactile person. That's who I am. Jeff's very electronically oriented. He's quite talented. I'm terrible at that. Thank you. These aren't permanent, are they? Good. Okay, that's a wet erase. A wet writer? Got it. Wet erase. So Deuteronomy chapter 8, starting verse 1. We'll go down. I just read, I'll reread verse 1. Every commandment which I command you today, you must careful to observe that you may live and multiply and go in to possess the land of which the Lord swore to your fathers. And you shall remember, the Lord your God led you all the way these 40 years the wilderness to humble you, to test you, to know what was in your heart, whether you would keep his commandments or not. He humbled you, allowed you to hunger, fed you with manna you did not know, nor did your forefathers know, that he might make you know that man should not live by bread alone, but man lives by every word that proceeds out of the mouth of the Lord. Your garments did not wear out on you, nor did your foot swell these 40 years. You should know in your heart that as a man chastens his son, so Lord your God chastens you. Therefore you shall keep the commandments of the Lord your God to walk his ways and to fear him. Pause for a minute. We'll continue on in a second. What was the accentuating point here? Humble you. Humble us. That was the accentuating point. Now I've asked you a question. When you see homeless people camping out in tents on the side of the road, do you envy them? Why? It's cold. Hard life. Is that a humbling experience to be? Yes, it is. I'm not referring to the drug addicts. I'm referring to just the existence of being in a tent on the side of a road. Is that a glorified experience? No, it's not. Being a homeless individual, is that a pleasant experience? No, it is not. It's not which we envy, is it? It's an embarrassing status. Now imagine you as an Israelite for 40 years wandering with tents compared to your contemporaries in cities with fixed houses made of brick and stone and wood and whatever else. Do your contemporaries envy you, saying, oh, I really wish I had that tent. I'm so upset I have this wonderful big house to live in. No, they don't, right? So what is the point of God's objective for 40 straight years? To humble them. That's what they're supposed to remember. So I ask you, what are we supposed to remember for 40 years they're dwelling in this? Humbling them, which means we humble ourselves. Make sense? That's the point. To humble yourself, just like God humbled your forefathers. The same principle, to humble yourself. We'll get the details of what that means. But that's the idea. The idea to remember that God humbled you. Tents are not a glorious thing compared to, you know, houses and bricks and stone and mansions or whatever. Not mansion, but some people do. Tents are very humbling. They're not a glorious thing. It's a humbling experience. That's what God wanted them to remember through Moses. Let's get you on in verse 7 to verse 8 of Deuteronomy 8. Oh, sorry. Where is it? Sorry, I stopped at verse 6, was it? Where did I stop at? Oh, there it is. Yeah, so we'll begin on verse 7. For the Lord your God is bringing you to a good land, a land of brooks and water, of fountains and springs that flow out of valleys and hills, a land of wheat and barley, of vines and figs and pomegranates, a land of olive oil and honey. A land in which you will eat bread without scarcity, and in which you will lack nothing. A land whose stones are iron and out of whose hills you can dig copper. When you have eaten and are full, Then you shall bless the Lord your God for the good land which he has given you. Beware that you do not forget the Lord your God by not keeping his commandments, his judgments, and his statutes, which I command you today. Lest when you have eaten and are full, and have built beautiful houses to dwell in them, and when your herds and your flocks multiply, and your silver and your gold are multiplied, and all that you have is multiplied, when your heart is lifted up, and you forget the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt from the house of bondage, who led you through the great and terrible wilderness, in which were fiery serpents and scorpions and thirsty land, which there is no water, who brought water for you out of a flinty rock, who fed you in the wilderness with manna, which your forefathers did not know, and that he might humble you, that he might test you to do good in the end. Then you say in your heart, my power and the might of my hand have gained me mine this wealth. And you shall remember the Lord your God, for it is he who gives you power to get wealth, and he may establish his covenant which he swore to your fathers, as it is this day. Then it shall be, if you by any means forget the Lord your God and follow other gods and serve them and worship them, I will testify against you this day that you surely will perish. As the nations which the Lord destroys before you, so you shall perish because you would not be obedient to the voice of the Lord your God. So God's reiterating that as you progress from your tent experience, your homelessness experience, your dwelling on the side of the road experience, your tents and your awful place, so to speak, as you grow and increase your wealth, that you don't forget where you came from. Where'd you come from? So I have a question for you. Don't answer it, but just think about it. Okay, rhetorical question. Each of you have a past. Good and bad and different, all pasts. Things you did that you're proud of, things you did you're not proud of. All right? When you transition in your life and you gain wisdom and age and experience, you look back at your past, you can decide, was this good, this event or action, or that? And you can decide, this was a good choice, that was a bad choice, right? We all do that. That's part of our nature. We look back, that was a bad choice, I won't do it again. That's pretty typical. Now, what if, for example, we forget where we came from? Let's imagine for that you only remember all the great things you did, which I'm not saying it's a bad thing, but if you only remember the good things you did and you don't remember the bad things, the mistakes you've made, did you learn? Did you learn from mistakes? We all learn from mistakes. I don't know about you. I learn more from my mistakes than my successes. I learn what doesn't work. I learn more from that than what does work. Because when it does work, I don't necessarily know why it all worked. When it doesn't work, I know why it didn't work. I can analyze it very clearly, all the steps that failed. So I learn more from my mistakes than my successes. Most people, I think, probably are similar. Not necessarily identical, but similar. The mistake, you realize that didn't work, and these are the reasons why. So if I forget my past, my humbled past, my beginnings of nothingness, if I forget that, I may forget what God is, what his intent was for me to grow in my walk. So write this. I have my whiteboard. Write a few things down real quick here. So first of all, we'd ask a few rhetorical questions initially as far as why to remember. So why remember? That was my question I'd ask. Why does God want you to remember these events? And I walked you through Deuteronomy 8, discussing the idea of the whole point of 40 years, Moses reiterates multiple times that chapter, it was to humble you, the Israelites. That was the goal. The goal was God was trying to humble the Israelites. So I remember, we're remembering the humbleness, or humble. That was what we were trying to be humbled. God humbled the Israelites. So humbled them. That was God's goal. So if God's goal was to humble them, and we're supposed to remember their goal was to humble them, God wanted to be humbled, what should my goal be? To be humbled. So that was God's goal, therefore it's my goal, okay? My goal is to be humbled this time period. So my goal for remembering Sukkot, why to remember, is to humble myself. Which includes, remember where I came from, good, bad, indifferent, whatever my past was, and my ultimate, my objective, what I'm trying to get to. So I humble myself, just like they were humbled because God humbled them. Why would God want to humble them? Pride goes to your fall. That is a true statement. Where'd they come from? Egypt. What was Egypt known for? Everything like here, right? So what was Egypt's greatest claims? There are multiple of them that you could remember. Just rattle them off. Things you remember or have heard about Egypt, the pharaohs and such during Israelites' time. Names and their pyramids. All right, so the pyramids. Leaks. Okay, so we'll do leaks. Wealth. Yep, you're right. Wealth. I'm terrible. Penmanship here. Well, hold on, wait, what was that? Gods, you're right, there are a lot of gods. I'll put the lower G. And what was it? Slaves, right? Slavish slaves. Yeah, the world power. Anything else you can think about Egypt, what they have? Anything else you can think of? This is a good list, by the way. They had Pharaoh, king. A lot of nations had kings, but we'll give Pharaoh. Pharaoh was a special one. He's a really big king. So a really good, a big king. We'll call him big king. Yeah, they thought he was a god, right? They treated him as a god, right? That's pretty. All these are, so I have a question of these items. Now think about this for a minute. When you think of the pyramids of Egypt, do you think, oh, how humble those are? No, we think, wow, that's a massively huge structure, very well built, interesting design, and people flock to it as a tourist attraction. They question how it was built, all these details. I'm not going to take details of that. But you know, think about that. When you think of the pharaohs and the tombs and all the gold and the silver they dump inside the dead men's body, dead men's tombs with a whole bunch of other people that died with them, do you think of, oh, how poor that country is? No, you don't. So poor, so wealthy, they can put their wealth in the ground, like bury it like dirt. That's what they're doing, right? You're taking all this gold and jewelry and silver, which is worth like gazillions of dollars, and burying it in the ground and covering it up. Said, next, it's almost treating it like it's as dirt. I'm not there actually doing, but it's symbolic or physically doing what some would think of, oh, this is junk, we'll just chuck it. That's the idea of what you're doing. You're burying something. It's obviously dead. They had lots of slaves. A lot of them said slaves, though. But they were a very powerful nation, weren't they? What about their army? Their army was pretty strong army, wasn't it? Even God had pointed out, hey, when you come out, don't go back there again because the horses, the chariots they have are impressive. So you will not return that way. And of course, Solomon didn't obey, but we won't go to Solomon right now. Some failed. So they're a very powerful country. And yes, they thought their god or king was a god. Are these any of these things indicative or characteristics of a humble nation? Not at all. Exactly. We brag about how expensive our weaponry is. Yes, in our current modern country, there is nothing really humble about this, is it? Is it not a humble? You don't think of, oh, Egypt, how humble they all were. That's the opposite of what we think. So this is a culture Israelites were growing up in, manifesting and taught and see as glorification of. So, for example, when you go to, I've never been to Egypt, by the way. If I ever went there, and if I ever saw a pyramid, I imagine I'll probably look up at it like this, right? And my head's going to go up. Wow, that's a really big thing, right? It's a huge thing. I'm going to look up. Is that designed to humble you? No. You're supposed to look up. Wow. This is not a humble position, by the way, in case you're curious. This would be a non-humble position. This might be up, but not the head up. So the whole idea is to make you lift up and look up and look how impressive this thing is. That's not humble. So imagine you're an Israelite slave, you know, 4,000 years ago. Pyramids are, most of them probably already built. I don't know when the pyramids ended or not, but they were building them. Are you surrounded by a humble culture? No, you're not. Now, you may be humbled because you're a slave, but the culture around you glorifies the opposite of humble. Yes, Tammy.
And in those pyramids back then would have even been more impressive because they were coated with, they were effaced with, I think, limestone or something.
Oh, right.
Like that.
I mean, like a
white
color.
So you couldn't even be able to look at
it. Super bright.
You're right. It'd be super bright. So yeah, you might be looking up, look at how tall this thing is, but you'd also be kind of
be shielding.
Shielding your eyes from it. They didn't have, I don't know if people had sunglasses back then, right? So it was, they were built to invoke awe.
Right.
Literally. Not just pride, but awe.
Yeah, exactly. And so that's, and so you're a slave, you're I don't know, carrying water or doing whatever your job is as a slave. And you're around, I'm not saying you're at the pyramids themselves, but you're around the culture that made these things. And they have other things too, I'm sure. And so you're growing up and you're as a little kid growing up and saying, okay, I work for these awesome, great, wealthy people. Look how great a stuff they make. Is your mind being trained at, oh, I should focus on my humility? It's not. You can't get that out very easily. And God for 40 years attempted to do so when he finally called it quits, I can't do it. Our own God said, I can't do this. I can't get Egypt out of these people. So I'll use their kids instead. Discarding them. I can't do it with them. They're too stubborn or too stuck in this. So that's, I don't usually think about something that God can't do. Well, he determined he couldn't do something. So I can't get Egypt out of these guys. It's stuck inside them so deep, I can't pull it out. I'm not saying he doesn't have the physical power. It's the idea that he didn't, the methodologies God, our God uses was not going to be successful in getting out of this group of people. I do realize they're individuals. What was that? Right. Yeah, exactly. You didn't break their free will. Now, I do realize there were exceptions, obviously. I mean, we have, you know, Josh was exception, right? It's an exception. Eleazar, an exception. There are exceptions, but God's talking about the whole people group, not the exceptions. So the group, the mass group, he couldn't succeed in taking it out of them, their history. So the idea of being humble was a difficult task to learn, wasn't it? Right? So for 40 years, he humbled them. Now at the end of 40 years, which we have proof of with Zelophehad's daughters, when they talk about their dead dad, they actually say, hey, yeah, our dad died in the wilderness and he died in his sins and he deserved it. Now think about that. Your kids come along, you're dead now. They come along and they're talking to their leader, in this case Moses, saying, yeah, our dad died. They're talking about you. You died and you deserved it. They got the message, didn't they? So, yeah, we get it. This humbleness concept could not be taught to my father Zelophehad. The children learned it. And how did they learn it? 40 years living in a tent. That's how they learned it. They learned humility, didn't they? A very low position in life, right? So does God's method do eventually work? It does, depending on the type of person you are. It does eventually work. Just may take a long time. So if our goal, God's goal, was to humble the Israelites, to bring them from their culture of glorification of great wealth and power, down to a more humble, you have nothing that I, God, don't give to you. You don't have your food that you can make because God's providing you manna. You would starve to death already. You don't have the water you drink because God gave you the water out of a rock because you don't have it. There's no water here. You don't have a house to dwell in, right? You have a tent, some carpets, and some whining animals, I'm sure, here and there who are, you know, probably having their issues. Everything you have, you didn't provide. Now, those of you who are used to being providers to your families, right? Those of you who provide the family as the dominant player, you do this. This is what your job is. Most, I realize this, I may be, you know, chauvinistic here. Most males, that's typically our job as dads, all right? Provide the family, right? How many of us have done that? Now, imagine for a minute, some of you are single moms, that's true too. Same principle. Imagine for a minute that you did not have the ability to provide at all for your well-being or your family's well-being. Nothing. You couldn't feed them, couldn't clothe them, couldn't give anything to them. You had nothing, nothing to give. How humiliating is that to you as a parent or as a husband or a mother, whatever your job is? How humiliating would that be? No matter how hard you work, you have nothing. That's a very humbling experience, isn't it? So God's putting this thing through them that, hey, everybody, you came from a place that you used to work for everything they have, and you have lots of stuff to work for, all these great, wonderful gifts of supplies, I'm going to bring you down to a place where you have nothing unless I, God, give it to you. You're very, very, I guess, a dependent is a good word for it. Essentially, you're like a child, right? Kids don't really work so much for providing for themselves. They kind of depend on the parents to do so. That's the state which you're being. So this is what God's having us remember. This is what most want to remember. This we're trying, their goal is to humble them. So when we dwell in sukkahs, for Sukkot, what are we supposed to do? Remember. Remember that humiliating stance, or humiliating experience. So when we go to Nehemiah, we'll go there real quick. I won't stay there for long because I have another place I want to go to. Nehemiah is a smaller book. He should have been bigger. Easier to find. I mentioned this just ever so briefly. They paused when they read the law of Moses, and they said they decided to dwell on bushes and trees to make sukkahs. It's down to verse, where is it? Chapter 8, Nehemiah 8. So Nehemiah 8, jump down to verse 9. Oh no, sorry, verse 8. Verse 8 of Nehemiah 8. So they, this referred to Ezra is reading the law out loud to people in their language, they can understand it. So it says verse 8 of Nehemiah 8, says they read distinctly from the book the law of God, and they gave the sense and helped them to understand the reading. So the people themselves didn't speak Hebrew anymore. They didn't hear or understand the language of Hebrew. Nehemiah was reading it in Hebrew. So they had to translate or understand what these words mean. That's what they're describing. In verse 9, Nehemiah, who was the governor, as the priest, the scribe, Levites, who taught the people, said to all the people, "This is the day, the holy Lord your God, do not mourn nor weep, for the people wept when they heard the words of the law." Pause. Why would they weep? Now think about that. Why would they be weep? They had not heard this for their entire lives. What would make them weep? They didn't know. What did they not know? They violated that. They weren't doing anything God told them to do. Imagine you grow up one day, you have no clue who God is, never, and then somebody finally opens a scripture to you, opens God up to you, and said, "This is what God is." You're shocked. What does he want me to do? How? Some of you may have experiences, I don't know. How would that make you feel? How did it make you feel? What was going through your mind? Like, God asked me to do what? I've been screwed up this long? Exactly. How long have I not known? My whole life. All those experiences, I didn't realize what I was supposed to be doing this whole time. God was very patient with me, wasn't he? How many years have I been ignoring and not know? And now he's telling you, why now? We all ask, why now? Whatever reason God says, now you're going to know. And now we know. So now they're realizing, he was screwing up this whole time for how long? All right. And going down to verse 10. He said to them, "Go your way, eat the fat, drink the sweet, send portions to those whom nothing is prepared. This day is holy to our Lord. Do not sorrow, for the joy of the Lord is your strength." Levites quieted the people, saying, "Be still, for the day is holy. Do not be grieved." People went their way, ate and drank, to send portions and rejoice greatly because they understood the words that were declared to them. On the second day, the heads of the father's house of all the people, all the priests and Levites who were gathered to Ezra the scribe in order to understand the words of the law. And they found written in the law which the Lord had commanded Moses, the children of Israel should dwell in booths during the feast of seventh month, and that they should announce and proclaim in all their cities in Jerusalem, saying, "Go out the mountain, bring in olive branches, a branch of oil trees, and myrtle branches, and palm branches, and branches of leafy trees, to make booths as it is written." People went out and brought them and made them booths, each one on the roof of his house or in their courtyards or the courts of their house of their God, and the open square and the water gate, the open square of the gate of Ephraim. The whole assembly of those who had returned from captivity made booths and sat on the booths, for since the days of Joshua, the son of Nun, till that day, the children of Israel had not done so. And there was great gladness. Also, day by day, from the first day to the end, last day, he read the book of the law of God, and they kept the feast 7 days. On the eighth day, there was a sacred assembly according to prescribed manner. So they're all experienced realizing the things I've been screwed up this whole life, my whole existence, by not only just me, my parents, my grandparents, my great-grandparents, hundreds of years did not know or did not realize what they were supposed to be doing. And that's what got into their mind. And what they do, obviously they were sad initially. Said, don't weep. This is celebration day. And so they got out of their houses, the nice big house they've just built, the rock houses. They put leaf bushes together and made sukkahs. Now, sukkah, it's little tents of branches. Now, is that tent, mind you, they've been working for years building Jerusalem. So they've been hauling stones and rock and everything else and mortar, whatever they got going on, to build their houses. So your house, let's pretend a minute, you build houses for a living. Some of you may do. And you build this nice, beautiful house. Great, it's lovely. The plumbing's in, the windows are in, the whole works are done. I just got it finished. We just moved in. It's been a few weeks. My wife's getting comfortable. My kids are happy. Yada, yada, yada. Now go build some sticks outside and live in that. Like, what? Yeah, wait a minute. I spent a lot of effort on this. Yeah, you're not living in there. Get outside. Okay, and of course, you're obedient. Because God explains this is what your job is to do. So that's also, even though it's minor in comparison to coming out of Egypt, the principle's still the same. I worked really hard for this. This house I just built, or just repaired, if it was repaired versus built. But I'm not going to live in it. I'm going to get out of it. You know, I spent all this work, because again, the same principle applies to 40 years of wilderness. All your provision only comes from God to begin with. No matter how hard those men worked and built those walls and rebuilt Jerusalem, who is the one that allows it to succeed or fail? Only God does. And I do realize that the passages, which we won't get to today, about them having to hold swords in one hand while their chisels in the other hand, because the enemies try to kill them in the process. And they only succeed because God said, I will allow this to succeed. So again, that's still, technically speaking, you're looking at it, it's still a humbling experience. It may be different, not the same scale as wandering wilderness for 40 years, but the principle is still the same. It's the memory. What was the goal? Remember. Remember where you came from. Remember where you actually, what you actually are. It's not the stuff you have, it's the place you live, the food you eat. It's what you are. And what are you? Only a servant of God. Only his child. Which is a good thing, but that is your definition. Yes, Pebble. We should be camping. I'm not going to tell you what you should or shouldn't do. That's between you and God, not me. I'm camping. But that's because that's where we're doing my in-laws' backyard on their porch. So let's go see. We'll get more to cover than this. So I have a little bit of time left, not much. So 1 Kings 8 was read, part of it was read today, regarding the things that Solomon had said regarding the temple that God had built, or actually Solomon built it, David designed it. It's a lot of, you know, people hands in that process. But there's a few things in 1 Kings 8 I want to talk about, just a few, because I want to hit another scripture later, shortly, in a few minutes. So firstly, back to 1 Kings 8, there's a few passages that weren't part of today's reading, per se, but they're part of Solomon's whole speech. And there are specific things I want to bring your attention to. So just like we have a sukkah, we have a house, we have things that we can look at and remember and do this holy day cycle, well, God had a temple that was built for him too. Now, remember, a temple is nothing more than a sukkah, but it's like God's version, okay? So you have a house, and you may have a sukkah somewhere, maybe your property or somewhere, I don't care what it is, just some space. And you may be dwelling in one or the other. Well, God has a house known as all of creation. Because what did he not make, right? Everything is his. And someone recognized that in his speech, his prayer. All of creation belongs to God. That is his home, his true place of dwelling, which is everything and everywhere. But yet, a physical structure was built from rock to hang out in, live in, sort of, like kind of dwell there at times. And Solomon's realizing this is absurd. Well, the creator of all things going to dwell in a rock structure. That's ridiculous. But that's not Solomon's point, isn't to point out that it's ridiculous. His point is to focus on what is our job as people, because we can't do what God does. What's our job as people to recognize what this is like? It's a simile, so to speak, as a sukkah. So 1 Kings chapter 8, jumping down to verse, one moment please. Go down here. There's a few verses actually. What if verse 30, like verse 33. So these are the points which the Israelites realize in their experience of life that they're humiliated, that they've been humbled. So verse 33 of 1 Kings 8, when your people, Israel, are defeated before an enemy because they have sinned against you, and when they turn back to you and confess your name and pray and make supplication to you in this temple, then hear in heaven and forgive the sin of your people, Israel, and bring them back to the land which you gave to their fathers. Now let's jump down a little further on. Verse 37. When there's a famine in the land, pestilence or blight or mildew, locusts or grasshoppers, when their enemy besieges them in the land of their cities, whatever plague or whatever sickness there is, whatever prayer or whatever supplications made by anyone or by all your people Israel, when each one knows the plague of his own heart and spreads out his hands toward this temple, then hear in heaven, your dwelling place, and forgive, and act and give to everyone according to all of his ways, whose heart you know, for you alone, the heart of all the sons of men, that they may fear you all their days, and they live in the land which you gave to our fathers. I'll stop there for a minute. What's Solomon's theme here? What was that? Prayer? It's a big part of it. What is the realization that people are supposed to get to produce that prayer, that supplication? Yeah, this was to realize I'm in a bad place, right? I'm in a struggling point in life, a situation which I'm struggling and failing at. And it's, even though I have the tools to fight my enemy, I have the tools to fight the plague, I'm not succeeding, am I? Right? Is that a humbling experience? Yes, it is. So what are they actually doing? They're humbling themselves, aren't they? When they humble themselves, well, Saul was saying, when they humble themselves, then God, when they come out of Egypt, humble themselves, then God remember and heal them, take care of them, answer their prayers. So it's still a spiritual concept, isn't it? You're always walking the spiritual concept. The idea that a sukkah or any concept of hanging out for 40 years of wilderness in a tent or whatever structure you happen to have had, it's a humbling experience. So for the sukkahs, the sukkot, this whole 7 days, well, plus one, seven plus one, almost eight, sort of. What's the goal? To always humble yourself. Now, I could have a beautiful sukkah outside, couldn't I? Why not? I could have an ugly one outside, couldn't I? Why not? Does it matter? No, it doesn't. It doesn't matter. Is it the same as a house? No, it isn't. Okay. The sukkahs don't withstand weather, do they? Cold, anything. They don't withstand anything. We have tents, right? It's damp in our tent. Everything's wet. It's so wet here all the time. it's not a very pleasant experience. It doesn't matter how pretty it looks, how ugly it looks. It's a sukkah. It's a temporary dwelling place. Yeah, Occident was very, very cold and wet. You're absolutely right. That was difficult and moldy. Yes, Rose. Old drapes, yeah?
I tied them around my fig tree.
That works.
And I put my two... deck chairs inside
of it. Yeah.
So that's
simple,
my sukkah.
Right? It's simple, right? Nothing fancy. Yeah. Is that an envious structure?
All close pinned together.
Don't your neighbors come by and say, oh, please, Rose, I want to live in there too?
No.
No, they don't.
No, they go, what is that?
You're housing homeless people? Get out of here.
What is she thinking?
She's crazy, right? It's not supposed to be a glorified structure, is it? Very humble thing. Now, I'm not saying people don't make them prettier. That's not the point. It's really a humbling experience. That's the point behind it. So remembering Sukkot, we're supposed to remember to humble ourselves, to be a humble person. I may have the pyramids or wealth or slaves or power or whatever. I can't go that far. I may have everything else. For Sukkot, all that is cast aside. All right? Doesn't matter how wealthy I am or I'm not. It's cast aside. Remember where you came from. As Moses points out, when we're wealthy or rich or have all these great things, don't forget where you came from. The humble position is where you actually are supposed to remember. Stick to that. Recall that. And so our New Testament discusses this too in different forms. I'm over time a little bit, so I apologize for that, but I won't spend more than a couple minutes on this. So I happen to like James. He's one of my favorite, New Testament writers. He's my favorite. One of. No, yes, one of. Not the thing. He's one of. It doesn't matter. Anyway, so James, I like him a lot. Mostly because I can understand him very easily. He's very straightforward, and I'm a very literal person. So it works for me. So James 4, he discusses this topic about humbling yourself and the nature of what that's supposed to be look like or experience. So James chapter 4, sorry, verse 1. My eyes are too old. Where do wars and fights come from among you? That's James chapter 4, verse 1. Do they not come from your desires for pleasure that war in your members? You lust and do not have. You murder and covet and cannot obtain. You fight and war, yet you do not have because you do not ask. You ask, you do not receive because you ask amiss, that you may spend it on your pleasures. Adulterers and adulteresses, do you not know that friendship with the world is enmity with God? Whoever therefore wants to be a friend of the world makes himself an enemy of God. Or do you think the scripture says in vain, quote, the spirit who dwells in us yearns jealously, end quote? But he gives more grace. Therefore he says, quote, God resists the proud, but gives grace to the humble, end quote. Therefore submit to God and resist the devil, and he will flee from you. Draw near to God, and he will draw near to you. Cleanse your hands, you sinners, and purify your hearts, you double-minded. Lament and mourn and weep. Let your laughter be turned to mourning and your joy to gloom. Humble yourselves in the sight of the Lord, and he will lift you up. Do not speak evil of one another, brethren. He who speaks evil of brother and judges his brother speaks evil of the law and judges the law. But if you judge the law, you are not a doer of the law, but a judge. Therefore, there is one lawgiver who is able to save and to destroy. Who are you to judge another? Come now, you who say today or tomorrow we will go in such and such, such a city, spend a year there, buy, sell, make a profit. Whereas you do not know what will happen tomorrow. For what is your life? It is even a vapor that appears for a little time and then vanishes away. You ought to say, if the Lord wills, we shall live. Do this, do that. But now you boast in your arrogance. All such boasting is evil. Therefore, to him who knows to do good and does not do it, to him it is sin. In that humiliated state of mind, that humble position in life, we look upon each other as friends, family, loved ones, whatever it may be, and we will notice differences. I mean, we're human. We notice differences. That's what we do. That's how we learn from one another. How we treat each other is the important part of this. How we view the individual is important part. And it doesn't matter if it is someone who is a God-fearing person or someone who is not. That's irrelevant. That's important to remember that it's irrelevant. If you look at Abraham, he bowed down to men who worshipped other gods. The scripture, a few words he used, he worshipped them. So he's pressed to the ground. He didn't raise himself up higher. Look at Isaac. He bowed down to his own father. Isaac could have easily overpowered the old man. But no, he humbly walked to that altar and Abraham got his knife out or dagger, whatever it was, Isaac could have overpowered him. It wasn't that hard. We're talking somebody in their 30s, an old guy, like 140 years old. It isn't that hard to overpower an old man. I'm just saying, honestly. But Isaac humbled himself. He trusted something. Look at Jacob. He humbled himself multiple times to even Esau, whom God said, I hate him. And Jacob humbles himself. So it doesn't really matter if the person believes in God, follows God, or doesn't believe, has no clue who he is, or couldn't care less who he is. The humbling, the examples we have, they don't depend upon the quality of the other individual, do they? Doesn't it matter if I came from Egypt and I'm dealing with the Egyptians now or not? My position, my place, is I am low and I belong there. That's what I'm remembering.
You've been listening to a discussion at Hallel Fellowship. If you would like to hear more discussions or if you have any questions, visit the website at hallel.info. That's hallel.info, hallel.info.